Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, lift up your hearts, not your cell phones. Pope Francis reflects on how the Eucharist is a thanksgiving, not a show, and urges the clergy and the faithful not to take pictures with their cell phones during Mass. Meeting the Elders, an independent group of global leaders working for peace and human rights, speak to us about their meeting with the Pope to discuss global concerns. World War I, a dark age for American Catholics. We find out why by shining the spotlight on the role of the US during this war. And Vatican diplomacy, a delicate balancing act. We gain insights into relations between the Holy See and the warring powers during the time of the First World War. Speaking at his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Francis reflected on how the Eucharist is an amazing event where Jesus becomes present and reminded his listeners that the word Eucharist means thanksgiving. In improvised remarks, the Pope chastised the faithful and members of the clergy who take photos with their cell phones during Mass, saying the Eucharist is not a show and this practice was a very ugly thing. Linda Bordoni reports.
To the some 13,000 pilgrims present for the weekly audience, Pope Francis said that while at Mass the Lord is present with us, too often we talk among ourselves and we are not close to him during celebration. He explained that for us Christians it is essential to understand the meaning and the value of the Holy Mass in order to be able to fully live our relationship with God.
Per vivere sempre più pienamente il nostro rapporto con Dio.
The Pope remembered the great number of Christians who throughout the world in 2,000 years of history have given their lives in order to defend the Eucharist. And he said that still today there are those who risk their lives to participate in Sunday Mass. He noted that we must go back to the roots and rediscover the true meaning of the actions we carry out during the celebration of the sacraments.
Su che cosa significa per ciascuno di noi partecipare al sacrificio della messa.
Explaining that the word Eucharist means thanksgiving because we thank God for allowing us to receive him, Francis described it as an amazing event during which the Lord is present.
L'Eucaristia è un avvenimento meraviglioso nel quale Gesù Cristo, nostra vita, si fa presente.
But he said, too often the faithful describe the Mass as boring. Is the Lord boring, he said? No, no, it's the priest. It's the priests. Then the priests, he exclaimed, must convert.
Signore, noioso. No, no, la messa no, i preti. Ah, che si convertano i preti.
On a similar note, he posed the question, have you seen the way children make the sign of the cross? We must teach them, he said, how to do it well. Because that is how Mass begins, that is how life begins, that is how the day begins. And furthering his comments on how too often the Mass is lived in a superficial way, the Pope remarked on the fact that the priest who celebrates says, lift up your hearts, not lift up your cell phones to take a photo.
In alto i nostri cuori, non dice in alto i nostri telefonini per prendere la fotografia, eh? No.
This is a bad thing, he said. It makes me very sad when I celebrate Mass here in the square or in the basilica and I see many cell phones raised. And it's not only the faithful, he said, but also many priests and bishops. Please, he said, Mass is not a show.
Ma per favore, la messa non è uno spettacolo.
It is very important, Pope Francis concluded, to rediscover the true meaning of the Eucharist and of the other sacraments, which are the signs of God's love, the privileged way to meet with him. I'm Linda Bordoni.
Peace, conflict resolution, climate change, migration and inequality were just some of the global concerns discussed by Pope Francis during a private meeting this week with members of the Elders, an independent group of global leaders working for peace and human rights around the world. The Elders was established 10 years ago by former South African President Nelson Mandela and is currently marking the group's 10th anniversary with a special campaign called Walk Together. Just after the papal audience, Philippa Hitchin spoke to two of the founding members of the Elders, former UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan and Mary Robinson, former Irish President, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and more recently, UN Envoy on Climate Change. Philippa began by asking Kofi Annan about the issues discussed during their meeting with Pope Francis.
You're marking the 10th anniversary of this group, aren't you? Why was it important for you to come and meet Pope Francis on this occasion?
I think it was important for us to come because we share lots of common interest and values, and we wanted to engage with him and discuss how we can work together, how we can pool our efforts on some of these issues. We did discuss refugees and migration, nuclear weapons, which the Vatican is having a meeting on Friday. We talked about peace, mediation, and conflicts. And I hope this will be the first of many meetings.
So a wide range of subjects you were able to discuss. What was the message, perhaps, that you were particularly bringing as an organisation?
I think we were, first of all, expressing appreciation for the role he is playing, and for the fact that he, like the Elders, is trying to be a voice for the voiceless, the marginalised, trying to deal with the most difficult issues of conflict. And so we had so many areas in common. We were able to touch on quite a number. Also Venezuela, and in the Latin Congo. American context, the Congo, and climate change, which I was particularly leading on. And all of these issues the Pope has, in fact, been engaged on and given leadership on. So we felt there was a great deal of common ground between us. And there was also, I think, a lot of warmth and affection and humour in our meeting. I was very struck by how relaxed the Pope was with us and how much he joked. And it was as if we were a group that he could feel at home with, because we were really sharing common values, common moral purpose, common problems.
He's a future elder.
Well, I think he's a super elder.
The Catholic Church, of course, has been dubbed one of the greatest soft power networks in the world. I'm wondering, what other ways would you like to see the Vatican and more generally the local churches as well supporting your work?
Well, first of all, I think if you take climate change, it really is very important that faith groups, including the Catholic Church, because they're on the ground with people, embrace the importance of taking very, very seriously the threats, the existential threat of climate change. I know that there was a meeting here in the Vatican a few days ago on the health dimensions of climate change. And of course, the Pope's encyclical has been extremely important. Last Friday in Dublin, I actually launched the Irish response to Laudato Si, written by a number of Irish theologians, economists, etc. And I presented the Pope with a copy of it. It's very important that we were able to share common concern and hear his views, but also have the opportunity to inform the Pope of what we are thinking of, not least the deep problems in the Middle East.
Talking about the climate change question, you have your own foundation, don't you, for climate justice. I'm wondering what your hopes are as the COP23 starts up in Bonn, because of course you were at COP22, weren't you, last year in Marrakesh?
Yes, I've been at all the COPs since Copenhagen, and this is a very important one. It's an interim COP, but it's the first one after President Trump announced that the United States is withdrawing. They can't, of course, withdraw until the 4th of November 2020, and they will be there. And in fact, some of the officials that will be there are well known to the climate community, and we don't worry about them. It's the head of the Environmental Protection Agency that will be a problem, because he wants to talk about coal as saving climate, and none of us believe that. So it is really important that we have the first conference under the presidency of a small island state, Fiji. I've been to Fiji, and we're very close to the Fijian organising of this conference, because it's about climate justice. It's about those most affected and least responsible, and a people-centred approach.
Which echoes, as you say, exactly with the Pope's concerns at the heart of Laudato Si. What impact do you think does his encyclical have at that highest level of decision-making?
I certainly think it had a huge impact when it came out. You know, it put the climate story very much on the map in a very holistic way, which I very much welcomed, and a climate justice way, if I may say so. And it continues to be a very key document and a very key example of leadership. And it's obviously for the civil society and for faith-based groups of all persuasions, a very, very important document.
Kofi Annan, you're the current chair of the Elders, aren't you? A Nobel Peace Laureate. You're known for your work to reform the United Nations, strengthening peacekeeping roles. How do you reconcile this painstaking work that you did in a world where diplomacy seems sometimes to be driven more by tweets and where war rhetoric seems to be so dangerously on the rise?
It is worrying. It is. I'm concerned about that because you need diplomacy. You need to engage. You need to talk. Leaders need to listen. And leaders also need to know when to follow. A leader cannot expect to have it all his way. He cannot expect to win all the time. He cannot expect people to follow him
he
all
or
the
she.
Time. Yeah, that's correct. No, she has to understand that she has to let others win from time to time for them to follow him tomorrow, because otherwise it becomes rather oppressive and you lose the people. But these days, leaders seem to be raising their voices, shouting a lot, making lots of noise, and that is not leadership. Honestly, you do not need that. There are lots of threats, and that's not what we need. We need engagement. We need understanding. We need to make attempts to reconcile. Yes, there are problems. You need to talk to resolve them. You cannot resolve these issues with threats. And what bothers me is with these threats and counter-threats, attacks, and all that we need is one mistake, one miscalculation, and all bets are off. You know, I mean, this is an issue all the leaders have dealt with. President Kennedy and Khrushchev had wonderful exchanges of letter with maturity and sincerity and the importance of avoiding a nuclear war. And one of the, in the exchange, and Khrushchev said something that was very powerful. He said, if we do have a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead.
Interestingly, at that time, the Pope of the day, John the 23rd, we know, was in contact with the two leaders. What do you think is the role of the church today, perhaps, because Pope Francis talks clearly about exactly what you're saying, building bridges, engaging, listening.
I think it's important that the church continues to do that. And Pope Francis is given wonderful leadership. And his leadership that is needed, he's not only talking to the men and women at the top of their governments, he's also talking to the congregation and people at large. And that is important, because that encourages them also to put pressure on their leaders to move these important items up the political agenda so that the leaders cannot ignore them and they take action. So that voice of the Pope is extremely important. It cannot be underestimated.
I'd like to ask you also about Myanmar, where the Pope will be travelling at the end of this month. You chaired, didn't you, the advisory commission on Rakhine State in Myanmar, and you presented your report the day before the latest round of violence broke out in the Rohingya villages. There seems to be a little progress since then in talks between Myanmar and Bangladesh, but I'm wondering what you think needs to be done there, really, to try and find a lasting solution to the ethnic and religious conflict that's going on.
That was the main thrust of the report of the Rakhine Commission. We came up with recommendations which, if applied in the manner that we hope, could lead to resolving some of the root causes.
Do you see this as largely a political conflict, or is it about religion, about ethnicity?
It's a mixture of all these things. It's political, it's land issue, it's religious, is historical. And so you can have your pick.
In this context, this very complex context, what difference can Pope Francis make as he travels to these two countries?
I think his message of reconciliation, his message of compassion and empathy, his message of caring for your brother or sister is extremely important. He has a voice, and he'll be given a voice to the voiceless.
Finally, you both mentioned his leadership on the broader issue of migrants and refugees. What else would you like to see the churches doing? Because there is a tension between what governments can do to integrate, to absorb the refugee flows, and sometimes the Pope's message, which is just open your doors and keep them open as much as possible.
We were very keen to encourage the Pope to continue to speak out, as he is doing, but also we have worked with Louise Arbour, who is preparing the Global Compact on Migration. We've worked on the Global Compact on Refugees. We're very supportive of trying to have a better way of managing the issue, because speaking from a climate justice perspective, it's going to get worse.
And I believe the Pope should continue to speak out. He should not only speak out to the leaders, but hopefully his voice will be amplified by the bishops, by the cardinals, and the congregation. Because when the congregation picks up the message and begin to put pressure on the politicians, they will do what is right. And in fact, where the people begin to lead, often the politicians follow. So I hope that's what will happen.
And that was the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. And you also heard the voice of Mary Robinson, former Irish president. They were interviewed by Philippa Hitchin. This week marks the anniversary of the end of the First World War, and so let's step back in time and find out why this period was, in the words of a leading historian, a rather dark age for American Catholics. Professor Gerald Fogarty is a Jesuit priest who teaches at the University of Virginia, and he spoke to Veronica Scaresbrick about the role played by the US during World War I, as well as by leading members of the Catholic Church in America.
The United States and World War One. Well, they didn't join the war until 1917, no? So they weren't terribly involved, were they?
No, and one of the interesting things was the Holy See, at the time, tried to get Cardinal Gibbons, the only cardinal in the United States, in Baltimore, and Washington was part of the Archdiocese of Baltimore at the time, and they tried to get him to intervene with President Woodrow Wilson, especially in regard to the Article 15, of the secret article in this Treaty of London in 1915, which excluded the Holy See from any type of peace negotiations. It was known by the Holy See very quickly. It was not as secret as they thought. But nevertheless, Gibbons did not have good relations with Woodrow Wilson because Woodrow Wilson was quite anti-Catholic and anti-hyphenated American. He is quoted as saying when he was on his way to Versailles that some of the Irish Americans came to him about putting Ireland on the agenda. He says, "I thought I would tell them to go to hell, but I decided to spare myself such an unstatesmanlike remark." Well, Gibbons knew he couldn't get anywhere, and therefore he didn't want to embarrass the American church. The Vatican did not understand his position. So finally, the United States got involved, and Gibbons and other leaders supported the entrance into the war. There's a picture of Cardinal Gibbons and former President Teddy Roosevelt at a rally together, raise funds, war bonds, at a park in Baltimore. So once the United States was involved, of course, it was a problem because Woodrow Wilson finally came as the great leader. The time of Versailles, only under some pressure did he actually visit the Pope. He was going to be in Rome, and they said, "You really can't go to Rome without seeing the Pope," Benedict the 15th. And he did, but it was sort of a cold meeting.
This was 1919.
Yeah, after the war. 1917 is when the United States got involved, and that's when the United States started looking like a world power. Most Americans are oblivious to history. Whatever that didn't happen in their lifetime never occurred. But, for instance, the state where I live, Virginia, in Norfolk, in that area, it's the largest military base in the world. It's Air Force, Navy, and Army. And one of the things was only On July 4th, 1917, did Norfolk become a naval base? It was always there. No, it wasn't. Because we had a fleet, but it really didn't have a major operating station, as they put it. So this is the period when the United States was on the brink of entering into world affairs. And certainly Woodrow Wilson and the entrance of the United States provided the balance of power. Now, the thing that complicated American participation was the fact that the United States was and is still a nation of immigrants. One of the things was, where were German Americans going to stand on this? Well, in 1915, a major diocese in the United States, archdiocese, was vacant. Previous bishop had died, and the priests at that time had a right to nominate a bishop, and then the bishops of the province were to meet on it. The priests of the diocese nominated a man who had been very popular with the priests, and then was bishop of one of the subordinate sees. His name was Muldoon. The bishops of the province turned it down, but of course they couldn't give their reasons for turning it down, because the bishops are all there. They're supposed to give canonical reasons. So the rumor started around that the bishop's name would begin with an M and end with an N, so therefore everyone thought it was Muldoon. Instead, it was an auxiliary bishop of Brooklyn named George Wunderlein, if you can imagine.
So German origin.
Yeah. In fact, he went to propaganda college here in Rome on a bursar scholarship from the Archdiocese of Paderborn. That's where his parents were from. So they still kept. He was born in the United States. Now, originally, but this is not in the Vatican archives, he was to become the Bishop of Buffalo. And supposedly the British Foreign Office protested a man of German ancestry on the border between the United States and Canada in 1915. So the man who was supposed to have gone to Chicago was Dennis Doherty. He was sent to Buffalo, but then was promised the first available metropolitan see. So he was transferred to Philadelphia. Now, the reason for bringing that up is shows the complication of this ethnic pluralism in the United States. By that time, the German Americans were, in a sense, more assimilated to being Americans than the Irish were, because the Irish were trying to work. The Irish Americans were sympathetic with trying to get Irish independence. And the only case of any type of sabotage of any American ships during World War I was from the Irish Americans, not the German Americans. So it was a period of significance for German Americans for proving they were American. And Wunderlein would carry on as maybe one of the principal spokesmen for the Americanization. Later on, he condemned Hitler in a public statement. Well, it was not supposed to be public. I'm putting
Who was this.
Cardinal Wunderlein, he was made a cardinal in 1924. He said in a speech supposedly only to his clergy in 1937, "I'm embarrassed at the German people for accepting an Austrian paper hanger, and a bad one at that, I'm assured." Paper hanger was an American expression for someone who pretended to be a great artist, great painter, when they just simply reproduced things. And he was making a slur on the fact that Hitler had proposed himself as an artist. Now, but it was a good indication of what happened in World War I to many of the German Americans. They became now very American. The tragedy was, in many ways, that the Americans then retreated in isolationism, and there still is great controversy of the United States getting involved in World War II. I mean, there's all sorts of conspiracy theories that President Roosevelt knew about the forthcoming attack on Pearl Harbor but did nothing. The trouble is our intelligence was not that good when all was said and done. Nobody had really great intelligence. But World War I was certainly the turning point for recognizing the United States as a world power, even though the United States retreated in isolationism.
So that's the reading of why it took the Americans so long to take part in the war. But didn't the church oppose war as such?
That's always the complicated issue with the just war theory. Well, the United States, until the sinking of Lusitania with Americans on board, remained out of it. And they were looking for an excuse to enter the war in many ways, at least Woodrow Wilson was. And Woodrow Wilson, I think, had this vision of the United States leading the world. And, of course, that was going to be rejected by the United States Senate. He was a Presbyterian, son of a Presbyterian minister, and he saw himself as the leader of this country that really was God's chosen people. So he was very evangelical in that sense, and he remained somewhat controversial. The sinking of the Lusitania provided the excuse, in a way, that this was, therefore, the United States had to defend itself. And many of the Catholic leaders in the United States were hesitant, like Gibbons, but nevertheless, almost was compelled to state the church would be, the Catholics would be loyal to the government. It was a time, by the way, where, for instance, in the city of Washington, there were a number of German orders of nuns providing staff, you know, for the cooking and so forth at a number of the religious houses around the Catholic University of America. Every religious order has an establishment there. And all those of German birth were ordered to leave the city. You know, it was a rather dark age for the American Catholic.
That was Jesuit historian Gerald Fogarty speaking to Veronica Scaresbrick. Staying on the theme of the First World War, let's cross the Atlantic Ocean and shift our spotlight to the role of Vatican diplomacy during this global conflict. Professor John Pollard is a historian at Britain's Cambridge University and the author of a book about the papacy during the First World War called Benedict XV and the Pursuit of Peace. He spoke to Veronica Scaresbrick about how the warring powers during World War I had a vested interest in seeking to enlist the moral support of the Holy See, and the latter was forced to perform a delicate balancing act to maintain its neutrality.
Every side wanted its moral support, and indeed, if you look at the Vatican archives in this period, they bulge with red, green, blue, white books about the atrocities of each side, sent in, of course, by the two sides, trying to get the Vatican to commit itself, trying to get the Vatican to condemn the activities, the war activities of one power against another power. And the Vatican had huge difficulties trying to steer through this, because obviously what Benedict and his Secretary of State, Pietro Gasparri, were trying to do was to maintain a position of neutrality and impartiality.
Difficult during a war?
Very difficult, particularly when they had their own war aims.
You say they had their own war aims?
Yes, they had their own war aims. I mean, fundamentally, what the Vatican was committed to was preserving the status quo, ante bellum, because that preserved the balance of power between, on the one hand, Catholic Austria-Hungary and Germany, which was essentially under Protestant Prussian control, but also between Catholic Austria-Hungary and Russia, which, of course, was an Orthodox, the Orthodox state. And there was a certain paranoia in the Vatican throughout the whole period of totalitarianism, by the way, right the way down to after the Second World War, about the threat of Orthodoxy.
How did the Pope communicate with the various powers of the time in those days? I mean, we didn't have telephones or things like that. Diplomats had a big role.
Yes, I mean, they had to telegraph, and eventually after the British re-established relations in 1914, they re-established relations very quickly. And then the French sent an unofficial embassy to the Vatican because, they realised the importance, you know, of, as it were, the Catholic vote. They essentially communicated through their representatives or by letter so that diplomatic documents were issued and distributed to the powers, even those powers with whom the Vatican did not have diplomatic relations. So that, for example, the Vatican had communications with President Wilson's United States of America in 1917. And it tried very hard to persuade the Americans not to enter the war in 1917, just as it had tried to persuade the Italians not to enter the war in May 1915.
It was not very successful.
It was not very successful.
That was British historian and expert on the papacy, John Pollard, speaking to Veronica Scaresbrick. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.